Patrick Timpone, and we are live here this morning with Dr. Ray Peet. Dr. Peet is a PhD. He's been at this a very long time. It is raypeet.com, and you can get his newsletter. We'll tell you how to do that. He has an amazing amount of material there, all kinds of articles that will help you to look at health in a way that a man with the many, many years of experience, going back to his work with progesterone and hormones back into the mid-60s, and he's done papers in physiological chemistry and physics in 71 and 72. His dissertation, University of Oregon in 72, outlined ideas regarding progesterone and hormones closely related to it. Dr. Ray Peet is here on the third Monday of each month, and it's just, Dr. Peet, thank you so much for coming once a month, and appreciate your patience with starting a little bit late. How are things up in the Northwest, sir?
Oh, pretty good. The weather has been warmer than usual for several days now, a little rain.
Yeah, but things are well up there.
Yeah, spring is coming on.
Before we, I want to talk a little bit about the exosomes and viruses and Zach Bush's work that I got turned on more, mostly because of you. You mentioned it last month. What are some of the biggest things that you have learned over the years, looking at hormones and progesterone and all that? I think, what now, almost 40 years, right? Did you come across a lot of things that you changed, and your whole idea changed on it, research and experience over those years?
Oh yeah, my own diet changed a lot as I studying the effects of estrogen interacting with fertility and aging in animals, for example. I came across lots of research going back to the 1940s showing that the polyunsaturated fats are estrogenic, that vitamin E, going back to the Schutz work in the 1930s, is an anti-estrogen, anti-inflammatory. Estrogen is both pro-inflammation and pro-cancer and pro-aging, but the arrival of the estrogen industry in 1940 changed the world's interpretation of not only estrogen, but vitamin E and the polyunsaturated fatty acid. So that was a kind of a turning point in my diet.
Interesting. So vitamin E, even supplementally, Dr. Peet, is a good anti-estrogen thing, which generally is good to keep estrogen happy, or did I misinterpret what you say?
It's anti-inflammatory, and that amounts pretty much to being anti-estrogenic.
Mm-hmm.
And it, vitamin E, facilitates good oxidation, where estrogen interferes with the proper use of oxygen. That's the core function of estrogen, is to block normal respiration of cells.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we get enough? Can we get enough vitamin E through the sunlight?
No, vitamin E.
I'm sorry, I'm confusing D and E. Sorry, I got confused. Go ahead.
If we have a diet free of polyunsaturated fats and no exposure to estrogens, then we need extremely little vitamin E, because its main function is defensive against the estrogenic substances and polyunsaturated fats. But if you are already fairly well saturated with the PUFA fats, then your requirement for vitamin E goes up and up with aging. Some studies suggested that the older you get, the more vitamin E you need, just to prevent the rancidity of the polyunsaturated fats in your tissues. some studies suggested that it reached a need for 400 milligrams of vitamin E per day by the time of middle age or menopause. But at that point, no matter how much you take, the rinsidity is going to take over and have an estrogenic pro-aging, a pro-inflammatory effect. So the only real solution is to minimize the absorption of the polyunsaturated fats.
And what are the biggest ones that people consume ongoing, say, in our culture, PUFAs? Would that be like the Wesson oil and these kinds of things, these really bad oils from the store?
The liquid oils and fish oil is a newer addition, but it's especially bad, fish oils and algae oils. But the seed oils like cottonseed oil and canola and so on. In the lab, when I was working on the effects of estrogen on those fatty acids in the body, I bought a bottle of some kind of Wesson oil or something like that, a liquid oil.
Right.
And I had my apparatus set up for measuring animal oxygen consumption, and I just put a rubber tube attached to the top of this quart of vegetable oil, put the other end in a beaker of water, and I came back a couple of hours later, and the water had been drawn up the tube. The oil itself, a bottle full of oil, but with a cap off and exposed to oxygen, was consuming oxygen, just like there was a little animal in the bottle respiring. So the oil constantly, on exposure to air, is becoming rancid. And that was at room temperature that the bottle of oil was sucking up the oxygen. And imagine at 98 degrees Fahrenheit how fast that rancidity process is going to be consuming the oxygen in your tissues. That makes it act like estrogen to compete against your mitochondrial energy production. Your fat cells begin sucking up the oxygen, and then the polyunsaturated fats reaching the mitochondria will slow destroy, damage its ability to use oxygen.
So olive oil is a monounsaturated, not considered a real PUFA, even though it has some PUFA kind of characteristics?
Yeah, where some of the oils are 50 or 60% PUFA, olive oil is 8 or 10 or 11% PUFA. So it's much, much safer than...
Sure.
And butter is 3% roughly. So it's...
Good for butter, huh? Yeah, wow.
Yeah, much better.
So what do you think is the safest way? My grandma used to buy these great Italian olive oils at the Italian store, and they were in tins, and she would keep it in a cool spot in the closet. Do you think a dark bottle or tins, or what would be the best place to store? Do you have any theories?
Well, it should be in a very cool place, best if it's in a refrigerator so it's solid.
Oh, really? Huh.
First of all, you want to make sure it's actual olive oil and tastes good properly like olives. The Agriculture Department, I think it was about 20 years ago, sampled the olive oil being sold in the U.S. and found that 70% of it was tainted with things like canola that are cheaper. It's somewhat of a gamble whether you're getting real pure olive oil, and pretty much you can tell it by the taste.
You have to be careful. So many of the so-called natural foods today, Dr. Ray Pete, have canola oil, and you can even get many of them now are using organic canola oil to make it sound better. But I take it you're just not a fan of eating this canola oil.
No, not at all.
Not at all. You just don't want to do it. Just don't want to do it, huh?
The reason the marketing started was that things like safflower oil and soybean oil used to be used as the basis for making paints and plastics. The oil chemists learned how to make similar, much cheaper paints and plastics from petroleum. So all of these seed oils lost their market as paint base. The marketing people discovered that if they could say that they contain something essential for nutrition, then they could say they're good for you. Even though the so-called essential oils, the daily requirement is in milligrams rather than grams, so there's no basis for saying that eating liquid oils is somehow related to an essential nutrient. It's all marketing that made up for the petroleum paint industry takeover.
So even extra virgin organic olive oil is more a luxury for taste rather than a necessary nutrient, in your opinion?
It does have antioxidants, vitamin E, and a lot of very effective health-related ingredients. So if you're getting a little olive oil, probably those beneficial things are offsetting the moderate amount of PUFA you're getting.
Dr. Ray Peet is here. We are live March 15th, 2021. If you have a question, we have lots of good ones already. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. I have not really have seen a lot of things by Dr. Zach Bush. And last month you had mentioned that we were talking about the exosomes and the virus and the germ theory, and you thought that his work was interesting to you. And I watched a 3-hour video. I don't know if you've seen this one. I think it was not. It's only been around 2 or 3 weeks. It was a 3-hour documentary that he put together. And on the face of it, it looks like he's onto a lot of interesting things. But he's talking about from the beginning that I wanted to ask you about this idea that these viruses, what they call viruses, have been around forever, right? I mean, just really since the beginning of time. And there's just thousands, millions, kabillions of them everywhere. Like he says in the air, there's 10 to the 30th of viruses in the air, 10 to the 15th in the body. I mean, that's more than the stars, right? I mean, that's, yeah, and in the soil. And that these viruses that they're called are circulating throughout the whole world without the need for a human transition.
They live in simplest organisms. Bacteria have their viruses, fungus, plants. Every organism has its so-called viruses. But the complex long chain of nucleic acids that is the essential component of the virus, you don't get the construction of this extremely functional, organized bit of DNA or RNA just in a vacuum. They require the living cell to reproduce. And it happens that living cells communicate between each other like bacteria. If they learn, if they adapt to an antibiotic, they put together a little packet of what they learned in their DNA and pass it on to other bacteria, even of different species. And that packet of DNA is spreading the ability to resist antibiotics, and that's going on constantly, not just bacteria, but higher organisms are emitting particles equivalent to the bacterial capsid or particle that transfers the ability to adapt better to the environment. Plants and fungus and animals all have this going on in their own tissues. One tissue sends out messages to another tissue and can recruit assistance from other parts of the organism send out repair particles to help other parts. These particles circulate in all the body fluids. A mother's milk contains these exosomes, virus-like structures that are ingested by the baby. The sweat, the urine, the saliva, all of our fluids contain these intrinsic communication particles that are working back and forth within our own tissues, but they're in our body fluids, and they get into the environment and can affect other organisms. And if it happens that it's something that works well in a plant, when it gets into an animal, it might be exactly the wrong thing. It might send out very confused signals trying to repair a plant cell when it's in your liver or something. And so these signals are alien when they're taken up randomly, and our bodies have to decide what to do with them. And much of this stuff gets tucked away for future reference in case it might come from a bacteria that knew something you should know, but is at the moment not useful. So it gets tucked away in our DNA, and about 97% to 98% of our DNA consists of strands that do not produce proteins. The genes that people have studied in genetics for 120 years are strips of DNA that contain information for making protein, but those amount to only 2 or 3% of all of our DNA, and much of the rest of it, at least 48 or 50%, it has the structure that would suggest it came from viruses. But since viruses can't evolve by themselves, it turns out that our internal exosomes that are repair modules, it turns out that they create exactly even the covering protein that we think of as what makes a virus travel and get into other cells. Even that covering protein turns out to be something intrinsic to our own regulatory systems. Since we share them, you can treat them as viruses, but they are built, they evolved and developed as part of our ability to guide development. And when these are acting during gestation, they're like the things we call cytokines. Mm-hmm. During gestation, these virus-like or exosomal strands of DNA are interacting with the potentially inflammatory cytokines as perfectly essential and harmless guides to creating the fetus. They are essential parts of forming the human being. And what happens in stressful environments, these things don't have adequate support of nutrition and oxygen and carbon dioxide and so on. Hmm. So under stress, these things that are part of our formative, protective DNA and cytokine system, these turn out to be maladaptive under bad stresses. and so they act like viruses when we're too stressed to put them to proper use.
So that's why Bush argues that some in the body, these exosomes and our viruses, exosomes, the body chooses whether or not it needs them.
Yeah, right.
It actually makes a choice.
Right. That's why healthy people don't have to worry about.
That's why they don't get sick. So then flu symptoms, and following what you're saying in Bush, it's not a bad thing. It's a genetic update, and the body is actually getting stronger because of it. Yes.
Right. Studies have found that kids who had normal measles when they were in grade school or so are resistant to cancer later in life.
Yeah. Dr. Pede, when I grew up in grade school in the 50s, we got the measles and mom put us to bed for a couple of days and that was it. And it was just no big deal. We just went back to school. And
the whole vaccine thing, it was the smallpox vaccine after thousands of years of practice, it became a usable medical tool. And finally, in the 1960s, they decided that they would get organized about it, and instead of vaccinating people where there hadn't been any cases of smallpox for decades, they decided to use it in a new outbreak and encircle the area where it was becoming an epidemic and keep it from spreading. So in just a few years, 2 or 3 years of actual organized activity, they eliminated smallpox from the world. But if you use a vaccine in that way, you lose your market for selling vaccines. So the vaccine for smallpox was used intelligently, and then there was no more market for selling it. So they never made that mistake again. The policy now is to vaccinate healthy people. Even though you kill some of them, it will keep the market going if you instill the idea that vaccines are something everyone should have.
So where did this organism, two questions. So an organism that was involved in an experience called smallpox is an organism that was not trying to do some kind of good for the person?
It was possibly...
Or could it be the same thing, that only the weak got sick?
In the great smallpox epidemics, there were always a considerable portion of the population that didn't get it. And things like getting enough sunlight and vitamin D and a good diet accounted for why those healthy people didn't have any problem with smallpox.
So this smallpox particle was not, its mission in life was not to kill people.
Yeah, it might have been to make mice resistant to mosquitoes or something. It might have had some useful function in some organism, but when it got in people, if their immune systems couldn't adjust to it and take care of it, then they would develop the disease of smallpox.
But at the end, if they had the proper, care, would the people that even experienced smallpox, could it be argued that they would actually be better off for it if they lived through it? No?
Probably, but it would be better to be exposed to the smallpox and handle it well so you didn't even get an itch where it hit your skin or nose or whatever.
I see. Which is the idea that they even do it today where moms who understand the measles mumps things, they'll actually have measles parties.
Yeah.
Right? So they'll send the kids to the party and drink out of Joe's cup because, you guys can share this thing.
Several big studies in India, for example, have shown that just vitamin D or just vitamin A, just some very economical change in the diet, stops the plagues of whatever polio or other viral so-called viral diseases. Just a very economical improvement of living conditions will prevent those deadly plagues. They happen in populations under stress, having famines and exposure to very bad diets, toxins, and just by having a normal, clean, well-fed environment, you don't have plagues.
So similar to people would die from scurvy, and then they gave them limes or vitamin C or something, and they were fine.
The vitamin D and A happen to be the ones currently recognized as providing resistance to viruses, but vitamin C had that function a couple hundred years ago.
So I wonder, before we start processing food, I guess people always had stress, right? They were fighting somebody or dinosaurs or who knows, right? Or, you know, big snakes or Indians. I guess they always had stress, so there was always it was kind of poetry in motion, Dr. Pete, of who was getting sick or who had symptoms and who weren't.
As the agriculture became the food basis of civilization, grains became an excessive part of our diet. Grains provide polyunsaturated fats and a variety of toxic nutrients, as well as a minimal amount of survival protein. So the more you lived on a grain-based diet, the more likely you were to have a plague, an epidemic of viruses, bacteria, and so on.
Dr. Ray Pete is with us. We're live here this morning, March 15th, 2021. Do you think that this human body that you and I are in and our listeners could have actually evolved all the way from the ocean all the way out to where we are today? What is your theory on that?
I don't think there's any good reason for thinking of the ocean as the source. The idea of a membrane enclosing seawater to account for why we have our mineral composition and so on, it's completely unfounded.
What if we leave the ocean out of it? Do you think our species, the bodies that we have in body right now, evolved from low forms of bacteria and viruses and came to where we are today?
No, the viruses evolved from us.
The viruses evolved from us. So how does that work?
The exosomes that we need to make ourselves, they're shared, when you share them with someone who isn't healthy, then they become a virus or a disease source.
When we share them with somebody, but if they do okay with it and work through it, aren't they going to be healthier at the end of it?
Yeah.
So they should thank us when we give them the flu. Just kidding.
A good ecosystem isn't riddled with disease.
Yeah.
It's a collapsing ecosystem that experiences things like viral and bacterial epidemics.
But Bush was saying there's something like these retroviruses, and he had the name of it, that without all these retroviruses, this was the way that we actually became evolved into mammals and had babies in the tummy rather than laying eggs.
I think that's
Did I get
true.
That right?
Right, yeah. The the so-called dark DNA, that 98% that doesn't make proteins, that's part of our structuring system. And our dark DNA, non-coding DNA, is different from the egg-laying organisms. Hmm. That's where our difference lies.
So somehow there had to be an intelligence or a desire, you know, working with God, whatever God is, to want to move from eggs to tummies, somehow.
Right.
We had to have a desire to do it, or that would never would have happened, right?
Yeah, James A. Shapiro, a bacteria geneticist, has written, and there are some very good videos explaining how bacteria have a very highly developed level of intelligence, and the idea that the world lacks intelligence is it's kind of a anti-religious bias or built-in philosophy to deny that intelligence is everywhere.
It's just everywhere.
Yeah.
So then the whole evolution and the divine, or what do they call it, God theory or evolution and what's the other one, the opposite? Theories and evolution?
The standard.
Standard one.
The neo-Darwinism is based on the assumption that the world is basically random and stupid and accidental.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well. So it kind of works together, doesn't the whole thing, if everything is intelligent and somehow a part of divine intelligence, which we might call God. I mean, it makes sense to me.
Normal reasoning processes will lead you there. You know the famous work on math that Alfred North Whitehead and Bertrand Russell produced around early part of the 20th century. Yeah. After they worked together on pure logic, Whitehead went off in his direction. He actually started using terms like God, but strictly building it on the same clear thinking that Bertrand Russell and he had developed. And so there's nothing anti-philosophical or anti-scientific. You can use that terminology without having to be a member of a church or something.
Dr. Ray Peet is here. His website is raypeet.com. You can get his newsletter. It's just Ray Peet's newsletter at gmail.com. Ray Peet's newsletter at gmail.com. So can it be assumed or argued that all of these things we call diseases, regardless of what they are, possible, and on some level spiritually, you and I and our listeners, we're trying to evolve, we're trying to get stronger, we're trying to move and change and to grow.
Even people who seem to disagree, like Kaufman and Bush, one says there are no viruses, the other says viruses are everywhere, but still what they have in common is there's nothing to panic about. There's no reality to the fear of the pandemic. And what that means is, how do you explain what the governments have been doing? That leads to the political agenda promoted by the World Economic Forum with the assistance of Johns Hopkins University several of the other traditionally elitist power groups.
So there's definitely, I don't think we're conspiracy theorists, whatever that means, or tinfoil hat people, to assume that there's just something rotten in Denmark as far as this whole whatever it's been over the last 18 months, right?
One of the key concepts of the Great Reset promoted is that no one will own anything, you'll rent everything. They are openly saying you will rent everything and you'll be happy without owning anything. But who are you going to rent it from? The World Economic Forum consists of thousands of people, the billionaire class, who are going to set the prices on everything that you don't own and have to rent. Yep. So it's very clearly an economic policy shaped to benefit only the billionaire class, the monopoly class.
I saw an article yesterday, Dr. Pete, where the writer was concerned and he was looking at numbers and saying how the richer nations were getting this injection, right, for COVID rather than the poorer nations. And this kind of is opposite of what people are arguing, that these people, whoever they are wanting to thin out the population.
You've seen the video and the articles by Gert van den Bosch?
Yeah, well, I sent you the one video, remember, on the vaccine.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, he gets very excited. He's a working vaccine specialist, well-informed on how the immune system works, unlike people like Fauci who know nothing about the immune system. But based on his good understanding of vaccines and immunity, he gets very excited and says it might already be too late to stop the terrible disaster that will result from using vaccines in the midst of a well-established pandemic.
Can you explain more about that? It was a fascinating interview. And I mean, in this fellow, Dr. Pete, as you know, he's not an anti-vaxxer. He creates and makes vaccines for a living. This is what he does, right?
Yeah.
Can you explain to us as simply as possible of his argument? And this is more, is this above and beyond the vaccines damaging the innate immune system that that Cowan wrote about 2-3 years ago in his book on vaccines? It's more than that, right? Than just damaging the innate immune system? Or is it all the same? Is it part of this?
It's helping to breed a worse virus.
How is that? How is it? Can you explain to us how this works if you do it in the middle of a pandemic?
The way the labs developed germ warfare viruses was to put them in one organism after another, keeping it under pressure, not enough immune reaction to destroy it, but to make one organism after another sick, passing it through dozens of different infected animals. Each time the virus fails to be destroyed by the immune system, it has mutated into something that resists one immune system after the other. And so the lab work decades ago was showing that you can evolve a very, very deadly virus in the lab just by keeping it transmitting through different organisms. And Van den Bosch is saying that the proper way to use a vaccine is the way the smallpox vaccine was used, not in a population that is already well
exposed,
infested, but to enclose, surround, and destroy the area where the infection is coming from. Definitely not vaccinating healthy populations, but using it intelligently. And his point is that the risk is that by vaccinating people who are already infected and healthy, as well as the susceptible weak ones, that the virus is going to get stronger and stronger very quickly.
Do you think he's right?
Yeah. I don't agree with everything he says, but his the vaccine that he developed, I think it was called Univax or Univac, something
right.
like that, was based on the idea of making stronger natural killer cells, which would be our innate immune system, not the specialized vaccine antibodies, but a general basic strengthening of the whole immune system and eliminating the infected cells so they couldn't produce more viruses. He points out that when you vaccinate a population and produce lots of people with a mass amount of specific antibodies for this particular virus, which then is going to change, but you've suppressed all of your generalized resistance, the basic natural antibodies and natural killer cells are subordinated, suppressed by the extreme amplification of a specific antibody for a specific virus. So you've over-specialized the population with this type of badly thought-out vaccine. And the very achievement of a powerful immunity against that virus is weakening your general intelligence part of your immune system, which can meet and resist any unexpected agent. That becomes weaker.
Wow.
You put all your effort into that fighting a virus which might never recur because the virus changes.
And then what could be some of the potential dangers to people 6 months, a year? Do we have any idea, or 2 years or 5 years from now, this injection? Do we know? I mean, have any theories?
The certain thing is that you've weakened and over-specialized your immune system. Many studies have looked at the people who got influenza shots the previous year. The next year, they are much more susceptible to the coronavirus.
Hmm.
Exactly the thing Vandenbosch is talking about. The over-specialization for one virus weakens your general immunity for everything else.
So can it be argued then that this whole corona thing of 18 months ago was no more than just a normal everyday life when people get colds and they detox or whatever you want to call it, exosomes, viruses, call it what you want. And if they would have just left it alone, it would have been we would have any of this, masking all this stuff.
The excess deaths analyzed, the data right from the CDC was analyzed by Genevieve Briand.
Yes.
She showed that their own data that doesn't show any excess deaths. It was just a standard flu and cold season.
And that was it.
You can't come to any conclusion except that there are political agendas creating fear to sell something that they're holding in the background.
So it's almost like Dr. Peeble would have to have been a really well-planned-out, coordinated effort between all these people, WHO, CDC, UN, the media, the AMA, the whole has to be, the whole thing was well planned out.
Right. The Rockefeller Foundation laid out the agenda about 10 years ago, and then just months before the pandemic appeared, the World Economic Forum and Johns Hopkins University had a practice run to get all of the government people ready and coordinated with the policy. So the record is there showing that it has been planned and that nothing real happened, but they were pre-informed how they should act and the policies that they should put in place, not for the public health, but for the interests of these of the powerful organizations.
And what are your opinions on what some of the motives were, are after with your own intuition, you deep down, what do you think these motives?
Exactly what the founder and chairman of the World Economic Forum has written, that it's to destroy the existing, they call it the legacy economy, to destroy the normal existing economies of the world and replace them with artificial intelligence owned by the monopolies, rented out to the public, but absolutely under the centralized ownership of the digital technology world.
This whole Great Reset thing, what's going to be involved with a lot of different ideas pushed forward?
The digitizing everything, eventually having artificial intelligence running school and university courses as well as medical procedures. New York was the first government to acknowledge that they were going to start putting in place the program of the World Economic Forum to replace normal education with online education, normal medicine with digital online medicine, replace a local economy with online shopping, so that the monopolies like Amazon will increase their wealth fabulously. You can see that the billionaire.
I saw that. Yeah, some of the numbers. Some of the numbers of these people. So, the whole eugenics idea of wanting to thin out the population—that's part of this, in your opinion?
It's interesting that Johns Hopkins University was so central with the World Economic Forum in the Great Reset, because they were the founders of the official eugenics office. Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory was pretty much a creation of Johns Hopkins University and their eugenics people. And their eugenics ideas inspired the Nazis. The U.S. Actually passed laws to sterilize people, that immigrant people who didn't speak English became candidates. The poverty class, malnourished and sickly people, if sickness appeared to run in a family, then you could sterilize them under the law of many states. And those ideas inspired the Nazis. So Johns Hopkins history is right in the same line as the current Great Reset policy.
But could this not work to their opposite conclusion, where all the people that they're able to control who watch television, you know, go to school, you know, that they're the ones that maybe won't make it through this in the next 10, 20 years? Or become more transhuman?
The direction of education under these this digitized centralization of power. It's to turn people into useful, profitable employees of these technological monopolies, or to let them maybe put them on a pension, keep them in powerless poverty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which could be what this whole universal basic income is all about and all this stuff, you know, that the globalists want to push forward.
Put the masses of the population on a pension and keep them harmless and quiet until they die off.
Harmless and quiet. Wow, brave new world. Do you ever think this would come about in your lifetime, Dr. Pete?
I feel that it's happening right now.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it sure is. Please stay there. And if you, thanks again. Thanks so much for being here. We're going to take a quick break and then promote a couple things, products. This is how we make our little house payment and our big house payment, however you want to say it. I don't know why I use that term. Doesn't matter. It's a house payment. We're very fortunate to have a house. God, I'm so grateful to be able to have a nice home to live in out here in the country. And thank you for your ongoing support. This is a good thing to do to detox from a lot of stuff.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, I did push the wrong button, and I want to get it here because I will. This is a sauna. This is a good one. Previously with cardiologist Dr. Joel Kahn, 35 years experience in cardiology.
On your commercial break, you hear a hot button because I'm a giant fan of infrared sauna and the cardiac benefits.
Tell us about why you like these saunas for the heart. What does it do?
In Japan, it's a traditional therapy of heart disease to even sick heart patients to sit for 15 or 20 minutes in an infrared sauna, then lie down and rest and hydrate for about half an hour. They call it Waon, W-A-O-N. It means soothing heat. And they've done research studies, like 30 of them, in humans. Anti-ages your arteries and improves the strength of your heart, and it may actually prolong survival in sick heart patients. Anybody can just, again, go to the internet, read about infrared sauna heart disease, or put my name there because I've written many articles about it. Now there's data coming out of Sweden and Finland because they've published some amazing data that number of times a week you're in a sauna, number of minutes each time, you can just track out how long you're going to live. So, very powerful therapy by being in, my favorite is an infrared sauna.
Well, and our favorite is the RelaxFAR infrared sauna that we've been promoting for, it's been about 10, 12 years right now. And I love mine, and I think you'd enjoy this. We promote these and are able to ship them all over the world. For some reason, the only place we haven't been able to ship them is Germany. Now, I choose to know exactly why that could possibly be, but Germany doesn't seem to be crazy about them. But everywhere else we can do it, and it's not as expensive as you might even imagine, because other than the United States, they're shipped from a medical university in Taiwan, and so they go right from there with the proper plug. So to get the price, the best price ever, is just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, if you live outside. Now, if you're in the lower 48, it's $1,195 delivered. Lower 48, $1,195. So just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
Previously, we talked with Brandon Amalani about his Blue Shield product to protect against EMFs in your home.
The more connected we are, the more electromagnetic radiation we're going to have. So years ago, I'd play with Q-Links and just anything I can get my hands on that, whether I felt it working or not, I just wanted some kind of leverage against electromagnetic radiation and those frequencies and how they affect the cellular biology. But then when I met Mark and started really getting deep to his technology and really looking at the microprocessing technology, I've never found any any EMF company that would not only to test on not only human blood and urine analysis, but also on animals, which totally weeds out the idea of placebo effect. I mean, the fact that you can plug these devices into a chicken farm, a factory farm, for about 15,000 laying hens, and all of a sudden the mortality rate, which is averages from 60 to 150 deaths per month, goes down to zero. I mean, it's pretty profound that a little device, a little energy device, could actually like create such a harmony and balance within the environment, to where claustrophobic chickens that are crammed in together actually get along better and actually feel better, and the biological markers are improved over that 1 year study.
There's quite a bit of science with this Blue Shield product. You can see the ad on the front page. Promo code ONERADIO will get you a 10% discount. This works on the cells in the body. Very cool technology. Front page, Blue Shield, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com.
Dr. Ray Pete. It is Ray, DrRayPete.com. Oh, just RayPete.com. Again, grab his newsletter. It's a great one. Every couple of months, it's not very, very, very cost effective. He just kind of gets it out there for you. It's Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com. Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com. As you know, Dr. Pete, we had quite the frigid, 2 weeks here about a month ago. And some of the people I talked to at the farmer's market, a man lost almost all of his pigs because they just couldn't take it. Isn't that amazing? Wow, man.
When it's cold enough to lower your body temperature, if that turns on improper inflammatory signals, and so it's at least as bad as having a terrible viral infection. The activation of inflammation comes on when your energy is too low, so it doesn't matter whether it's from a poison or environmental chilling.
It doesn't matter. So... But there's a lot of people that argue, like Wim Hof and others, and that cold water or showers or being out in the cold could actually make one stronger, no?
It's your internal focusing of your metabolism. The nervous system has to essentially intend to increase your metabolic rate, and you can keep your temperature up with the right attention. But the water that he can tolerate would very quickly kill a lot of people by lowering their temperature.
Very interesting. So let's get to some emails here, Dr. Pete, before we let you go. This one about aluminum wants to know, let's see if I can grab it here. I lost it for a minute. Oh, most perspirants contain aluminum. Are there any safe antiperspirants? And does the aluminum in the ones that do have it detrimental to our health?
The function of the aluminum is to kill and harden the sweat glands. So it's killing cells in your skin. So that they can't function. And I don't know of any skin studies of aluminum absorption, but the metals that have been studied, like copper solution applied to the skin, it immediately starts showing up in your bloodstream. So I don't think it's safe to assume that just because the aluminum is sticking to your sweat glands in the process of killing them, I don't think you can assume that that means that some of it isn't getting in your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Some people argue that many humans are low on copper. Have you ever seen any evidence of that? Low on copper?
The ratio between copper and iron and a couple of other minerals is very clear, so that if your diet has too much molybdenum, for example, or iron, that will give you a copper deficiency. And if you're under prolonged stress, mercury or aluminum or many other stresses that increase your cortisol will cause you to produce a protein defensively that binds heavy metals and will carry mercury and lead and aluminum out of your body. But in the process, that protein binds a lot of copper. And so whenever you're under stress, you're tending to lose copper faster than you could. That's probably why extreme stress can sometimes cause sudden loss of pigment in your skin and hair.
Hair, wow. So that just leads more kind of grist for the mill, this idea of when we worry and get anxious or whatever it is, fear that it's detrimental to our health. And physiologically, we can see that this is what goes on. We know it.
That one protein is just one example.
Yeah, just one, right, just one. This is from Terry's in Boise, Idaho, up there where the buffalo roam, or used to. Ray Pete, is the dark fairy, chlorogenic acid in boiled potatoes unhealthy? How do you say that word? Fairy chloric? Boiled potatoes unhealthy.
The green stuff,
yeah,
on potatoes.
Oh, is that what it is, the green stuff?
If the skin has turned green from exposure to light, that's pretty toxic. It should be trimmed off.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we boil potatoes, those are digestibles, right, as long as we boil them pretty good?
And they're almost a perfect nutrient. Don't have vitamin B12 or the animal form of vitamin A. Otherwise, they're an extremely balanced food. They don't contain much protein as such, but they contain the precursors that our body needs to make protein. So it turns out that there are cultures that have pork once a year for a week, and the rest of the year they live on potatoes.
You know, my mom tells a story that during the Depression, and that's about all they really ate was the potatoes.
The poor Irish were for a long time living on a mainly potato diet, and so when potato blight developed and they lost their potato crops, that was when the famine came on, because everyone was counting on abundant potatoes.
There's so many different kinds. We can get different colored ones, purple ones now at the hippie food store, and gold. And is there any that are better for us than others?
Well, those chemicals can be beneficial, but I found them to be extremely hard to digest. A lot of people have trouble eating purple potatoes or even the Yukon Gold because of the high carotene content.
Carotene
is the precursor to vitamin A, but if you are short on vitamin B12 or thyroid hormone, you don't convert carotene very well, and it builds up in the body and blocks the function of thyroid hormone, and then blocks the steroid production, like blocking progesterone. So you don't want to overdo the yellow and orange vegetables.
How about the red, little red potatoes, and the Baker's would be the best choice for potatoes if you're going to like...
The white flesh is the easiest to digest when it's well-baked or well-boiled.
The white flesh. So not necessarily, it doesn't matter about the red or the baked potato, because they both have white flesh, right?
The outside, the skin color doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. And so potatoes and carrots or squash with butter, it's a pretty good meal?
Very good.
It's better to cook them. Can you cook them together? I guess I did carrots and potatoes last night together. It works pretty well.
Just as long as carrot juice is a way that people often poison themselves getting too much carotene. Carrots and squashes, even though they contain carotene and related things, they have lots of good nutrients and other functions.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Mohammed. He's in Seattle. This is a question for Dr. Pete when he comes on the show. I met with some friends who got the vaccine in the last week and know that there's a possibility that some of the particles from the vaccine can potentially be in my body shedding. Is there anything I can do to detox this out of my system? I don't really plan on getting it myself, but I know lots of people I'll be around, family, friends, and coworkers will want to stay safe as possible. So do these things can shed bad stuff, these injectable?
There is some evidence of that. It hasn't been studied enough to be sure what's going on, but it's always protective to make sure that your vitamin D and calcium intakes are good. Vitamin D is a powerful anti-inflammatory agent, and that function is supported by making sure that you have a lot of calcium in your diet relative to phosphate. The phosphate-rich foods are meat, fish, and the legumes and grains. But people who eat too many beans in proportion to leafy greens and milk and cheese are likely to have a lot of inflammation-related problems.
So that's why you're a fan of milk and cheese, a good food, in your opinion, your experience.
Many metabolic activating effects, not just the high calcium content, but several other things that activate your metabolic rate and support your thyroid function so that you don't get into the stress inflammatory states.
Any idea where all of this anti stuff on milk and dairy products come from?
Probably many psychological things, like for some reason the medical world starting in the 1930s had a great phobia of breasts, and they didn't want women breastfeeding their babies, and they trained women to use artificial formulas. I think there's a psychiatric motivation there, fear of women, fear of women and children having actual skin contact to breastfeed. I've known people who extended that to have all kinds of strange doctrines associated with milk. But the theories have been developed to explain why people shouldn't breastfeed and why they shouldn't drink milk after infancy. But none of it was based on actual studies of what happens when people or animals drink milk as part of their diet.
This is a great question that ties right in. This is from Trent. Some people advocate if you're doing raw milk, regardless of goat or cow or whatever, that we boil it before drinking. Does Dr. Pete have an opinion about this?
If you think your cow might have a disease, or if the person doing the milking didn't know how to do it and let bits of dandruff and manure and junk get in the milk, bringing it to a boil or at least a sterilizing temperature of 160 or so degrees.
Would there be a difference between that pasteurization temperature, 160, or boiling, 160 might do it?
A little bit of difference, but not too much. Serious, yeah.
So maybe, maybe that's where it all comes from, and the idea from Ayurvedic medicine, which is centered in India, where this third world country, which is more, the sanitation, maybe that's where the milk boiling thing comes from.
I've bought milk coming in a big bowl or something and found bits of manure sedimented to the bottom.
Okay. Does Ray Pete have an opinion regarding the amino acid L-carnosine's ability to slow the shortening rate of telomeres? Resulting in life extension, as I had to cough there, as well as better health. Is there a danger of consuming 2 grams of L-carnosine per day?
I've never seen any studies on its toxicity, but a lot of things will change the rate of telomere shortening. I don't think of the telomere as such a great indicator of aging. Some very old people have good, strong telomeres. Some people in their 20s already have very short telomeres,
really?
But their health hasn't suffered.
So this telomere measuring thing to get your biological age could all just be one of those passing fancies that won't be around very long.
It might be around for a long time. I think was responsible for it was culturing in the 1960s. He was growing cells in culture, mm-hmm. and noticed that after about 50 passages in culture, 50 cell divisions, that they died out, and that was preceded by a shortening of the telomere. But he basically was doing a totally unbiological way of culturing with a buildup of lactic acid, which accelerates the aging and inflammatory processes, and in itself will shorten the telomeres. So it's all based on a terrible, non-scientific science.
So-called science, yeah. Ray Pete is with us on the third Monday of every month, and it's March 15th. We're live here. This is from WC, Dr. Pete, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, great part of the country. My wife has a slow-growing brain tumor that's moving towards the optic part of the brain, and it may need to be removed before a loss of vision. I understand you're not a brain surgeon, of course, and can't give medical advice, but can you give your opinion on how this may have originated and how to slow its growth?
It depends greatly on what tissue it started from. Mentioning the optic nerve suggests it might have originated in or near the pituitary gland, and many of those tumors are curable by a chemical. Bromocriptine or cabergoline are two of the chemicals that have been used to shrink pituitary tumors. And those tumors became extremely common after the birth control pill was introduced. So they're basically produced by an excess of estrogen. Tumors, even so-called malignant tumors, are restrained to some degree by aspirin and other anti-inflammatory things. Even antihistamines have a very basic anti-tumor effect. Anti-serotonin agents, because histamine and serotonin are tumor promoters.
I've known people who have been diagnosed with a tumor, albeit small, in the brain, and have just left it alone, have never been bothered by it. And do you think something like that, just with more anti-inflammatory foods and things, will it will just dissipate? Or
no? Yeah, I think what I think it was an English person who did the first study doing autopsies. He found that everyone by the age of 50 could, when he looked through their tissues, he found 100% of people 50 years old or more who had diagnosable cancer tissue in their bodies. And since 100% of living people in their 50s don't suffer from cancer, what that obviously means is that for most people, the majority of people, the presence of cancer that a surgeon can prove is cancerous, if it happens to be biopsied and studied, the presence of cancer in the body for most people isn't going to kill them.
It's just, in your opinion, it's just not a problem. Just leave it alone.
Yeah, that was finally put into practice in the case of prostate cancer. In the 80s, the prostate-specific antigen was discovered, and they started using it to diagnose whether a person had prostate cancer. And the standard treatment at that time was high doses of estrogen. And high doses of estrogen are not good for your health, but that was starting around 1940s. That was a standard treatment for everyone. And so when the PSA test diagnosed many, many more people as having prostate cancer, the treatment increased, and the mortality had a great surge in the early 90s. More people were dying from prostate cancer very suddenly, and they realized that the treatment was what was killing most of the people.
Because they were increasing the estrogen, which was making matters worse.
And someone did a survey at a convention of specialists in the prostate and asked them what they would do if they were diagnosed with prostate cancer. And most of them said they would do nothing because they had seen the effects of their treatments, but they went on giving the treatment to their patients, but they said they wouldn't do it themselves.
Fascinating.
And growing from that bit of publicity in the 90s, by the start of this century, the idea of watchful waiting for prostate cancer, that they acknowledged that you're going to almost certainly die from something else before the prostate cancer will kill most people. Just watching it became a better treatment, and for sure better than giving estrogen.
Jacqueline is in Pennsylvania. I often get severe headaches during menstruation. Does Dr. Pete have any reasons for the cause and cure of this?
I used to have migraines frequently right from childhood. After I had been working with progesterone for a few years, I happened to have a concentrated solution of progesterone and vitamin E as a headache was coming on. I took a gob of that, within seconds, the visual effects subsided and the pain, that got me interested in the vascular effects of a high estrogen and a low progesterone. The blood sugar and salt balance are governed by estrogen and progesterone balance, and the changing hormones at the end of menstruation, when your progesterone has crashed, then that's when you're very susceptible to migraines. Just eating a tremendous amount of sugar, I found, would block the development of a migraine. Essentially the same thing is happening when you raise your blood sugar strongly or raise your progesterone concentration in your blood suddenly. The inflammatory signals are blocked when you have a stabilizing factor, which could be sugar or progesterone or aspirin, and other things help, but sugar and progesterone are the most powerful stabilizing factors.
So Jacqueline could have a little bit of ice cream when her period is coming on, some ice cream.
Orange juice? Nutrition class once that I found that a quart of ice cream, if I could eat it before the peak of the headache, would block the rest of the headache. And one woman in the class giggled and said she had discovered the same thing, except it took a gallon for her.
That's great. Now, there's also, and I know you like a little product, and I think it's called Progest Ease. Is that correct? Is it?
That's one I
you developed.
Yeah, when I was working on it, I tested it on myself twice for migraines, and both times within about 2 minutes it was all over. So then I met a woman with multiple sclerosis and another one with an ocular optic nerve condition that was related to multiple sclerosis, and both of those women, one woman was giving it by injections and basically cured herself. She came to my endocrinology class. She had been bedridden for months and months, but when she discovered progesterone, she drove to Portland, walked up, I think it was three flights to my classroom, and lectured for an hour on the use of progesterone. Absolute strong health just by the use of progesterone.
Interesting. Where can our listeners get this Progest Ease that you developed, helped develop?
Kinogen has been making it for decades.
Kinogen? How do you spell that?
Kenogen.
Yeah.
Their email is kenogen at gmail.com.
Okay. And then you just need a couple drops of that, and so Jacqueline could try some of this when her period is coming on.
Would she? That's a first aid, but the reason progesterone gets too low and blood sugar gets too low is almost always a nutritional and thyroid-related problem. So you should check your thyroid and vitamin D and calcium intake, and usually that will take care of it.
Yeah, and she lives up in Pennsylvania, so it could especially be exacerbated during the winter when there's not a lot of sun. This is Thomas in Sweden, and goes exactly along our lines while we're talking right now. I wonder if Dr. Pete is aware of the work of a Dr. D-Z-U-G-A-N, previously connected with Life Extension, curing migraines, migraines too, and other chronic diseases with oral DHEA pregnenolone, as well as testosterone, progesterone, and estrogen in the forms of creams. Living in Sweden, I can barely get my hands on DHEA and pregnenolone, so I wonder if it done right, this might be enough to cure migraines for most people, myself included. Oh, very, very same genre of questioning here.
The ideal thing is to have such a good conversion of cholesterol to pregnenolone and of pregnenolone to DHEA and progesterone that you don't have to resort to stress factors such as cortisol, aldosterone, and estrogen. Those are opposed by pregnenolone, DHEA, and progesterone. And thyroid is the main factor for converting your cholesterol to those. So if your cholesterol is low, besides attending to your thyroid, you have to figure out how to get your cholesterol up to normal. But usually people with high cholesterol, when they supplement the right amount of thyroid, the cholesterol comes down exactly as the thyroid takes effect.
Interesting. Very good. This is from Jones. If one were forced to take a vaccine, would the J&J vaccine be the lesser of the two evils? What could one take to help offset the side effects of the J&J vaccine? Johnson & Johnson, I guess.
Well, it contains the DNA that makes the spike protein, and I don't think the spike protein is... yeah, you don't want a gene in your body for making this terrible pro-inflammation protein. I think it's the presence of the spike protein that is the danger in the long run. If you have the DNA for it, you can't be sure that DNA isn't going to become part of your own repertoire. And then that would mean that every time you activated that gene, you would be making more of the spike protein. That spike protein antigen is producing antibodies to specialize for it, and so it's damaging the rest of your immune system.
Mm-hmm. So, have you read anything that would support the idea that this Russian Sputnik so-called vaccine is a kinder, gentler vaccine? More with the antibodies and not so much of the genetic nonsense? No.
I've heard that, but I haven't studied it enough to know.
Here's from CB. I've read DNA is swapped between partners. If this is the case, can a vaccinated partner swap their altered DNA with a partner who has not been vaccinated? Wow.
I think that is being supported by some evidence. It just needs a lot more study, but for sure, a woman sampling her tissues and body fluids, but after death, brain tissue, for example, has been found. A woman's cells have taken up her partner's DNA. The semen is absorbed by the woman's tissues and become incorporated in all of the tissues of her body. So DNA from humans apparently has some good biological properties. The woman uses it in her process of reproduction, stranger forms of DNA, like from algae, can also be found in the brain after you've eaten a slightly harmful food.
Hmm. You've mentioned algae before. Are there any forms of algae, maybe fresh or something, that are beneficial? Like there's one that they promoted for years up near you, the aqua, you know which one I mean?
The blue.
Blue-green. Is that good stuff?
It's actually a kind of bacteria, I think, rather than a real algae.
So,
I think it's too dangerous. And even the real algaes have irritating and toxic and problem nutrients. Green plants in general have their defensive materials, so I think it's better to let animals with ruminants process plant material before it's taken in. If you're going to eat anything green, you should be sure that you know what the processing is doing, like a very long cooking of green leaves makes some of the toxins break down, but still you're going to get some anti-nutrient factors when you eat too many vegetables.
So that's why we want to cook kale well.
Very well, yeah.
Very well. Final one for you, then you get to go play. Assuming that thyroid status is optimal or supplemental as necessary, what are the expected optimal blood cholesterol levels for different various age groups?
Just the epidemiological information shows that after the age of 50, if your cholesterol level is not above 200, your risk of having dementia is a lot higher. And so that's apparently because not only your thyroid tends to become less efficient with aging, but all of the enzymes involved in converting cholesterol to the good protective things like progesterone, all of those become less effective in older age. So as you increase your blood cholesterol level, keeping those other things steady, you're going to increase your level of pregnenolone and progesterone, because cholesterol is very largely functioning as precursor to those protective steroids.
So that's why a higher 180, 190, 200, pretty safe and happy levels for most folks.
Yeah, and over 50, 220, 230 is fine.
Oh, so I see, yeah. Yeah, Dr. Huggins, one of our longtime friends, I think he even wrote a book, Dr. Pete, called 225, and that was his favorite number. He would test all these blood samples of people, and he thought that the 225 was optimal for people. It's interesting, 225. Well, Mr. Pete, it's such an honor to talk to you. Thanks for being there. What are you going to do fun today? Anything? Are you painting a lot these days?
Oh, no, not much.
No?
I'll be getting around to it.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about today. I'm working on a newsletter on inflammation right now. I'll probably be doing that.
And when does this newsletter come out on inflammation?
Towards the end of this month or beginning of April.
Of April. And if you'd like to get Dr. Pete's newsletter, is it Dr. Ray? I had it there for a minute. Oh, Ray Pete's newsletter, plural, right? Ray Pete's newsletter @gmail.com.
Yeah.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right, sir. Again, thank you very much for being on the show. We appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you.
See you real soon. Bye.
Bye.